and lifted it, tilting his face upward. Even in the shadows, she saw how striking his face was, how strong and well-formed, though drawn and creased with worries. The lines around his eyes suggested character and more merry days. There was also that nagging familiarity. She grabbed his chin. The cargo master started, but she whipped her sword to his chest. "Stand off," she told the old man. "I won't hurt your chief." She shifted the merchant's face in the dim light. Yes, there it was, in the dimples around his mouth, and perhaps the bright glint of his eyes. The shape of the face was different, though. She dropped his chin and then saw on his finger a familiar ring. She had worn its twin. The girl's features must favor the mother, but the ring was unmistakable. A fine chill tingled up her spine. "She should have killed me," she whispered. The merchant seemed to only just notice her. "What?" She looked right into his eyes. "I know her." Jindara swung around. Hamilton had another noble on her knees. He was about to place his hands full of magic, on her shoulders. Jindara would not interrupt him, and he would not notice her absence. She stalked down the throne room, peering into every alcove, testing the air before her with her sword. The greenie could be gone by now, for all she knew. Then, near the entryway, she saw it. A flickering light, a streak of green. Jindara pelted down the throne room and through the great doorway, past astonished guards. Here the corridor was well lit with lamps and candles, and the flames bent at the greenie's retreat. Down the corridor she saw the greenie run, transparent and ghost-like. No wonder the merchant thought his daughter dead. Holding her sword before her, Jindara charged down the corridor after the greenie. But when she rounded one corner into another corridor, she discovered it was darkened and the air thick with candle smoke. Jindara peered through the hall and into the shadows. "Careful," she thought. "The greenie could be armed." The shape of a person loomed up on her left, and in the blink of an eye, she swung her sword into it. A suit of armor crashed to the floor. The helm rolled down the corridor. Jindara narrowed her eyes as she stepped over a leg of armor and extended every sense into the gloom. But she heard nothing, saw nothing, felt not even a shift in the air. She smelled nothing but candles. Even then, however, another sense awakened in her, like a peripheral vision of the mind. She perceived the greenie to her right, tight up against the wall. Jindara shifted her eyes, but could see no one. Maybe there was a deepening of a shadow against the wall. She took a deep breath and held her gaze straight ahead, defying her greatest urge to take a direct look. That would only alarm the greenie. Instead, she slashed out with her sword. A cry of pain from the shadows confirmed her instinct had been true, and she laughed in triumph. Now she spun toward the greenie, just in time for another suit of armor to topple down on her. It took Jindara some moments to realize she was on the floor, her body hurt, pummeled as it was by age-old plate armor. She groaned and pushed the breastpiece away and untangled herself from the arms and legs. She felt around for her sword on hands and knees, and her hand fell into something wet. She brought her fingers to her lips and dabbed them with her tongue. Blood. Jindara raised herself to her feet and trotted back to the lit corridor. She grabbed a candle and took it into the dim corridor. She found her sword next to the twisted wreckage of armor. She looked in satisfaction at the blood on its tip, and the drips of blood leading in a trail down the corridor. Candle and sword in hand, she followed the trail like a hound on a scent. Blood Trail. Kerrigan leaned into a darkened doorway, sucking in painful breaths. One hand clutched the doorframe, the other closed on the wound beneath her ribs. It was not too deep, but it bled profusely and stung painfully. Dim light glowed in an adjacent corridor, but she had to drop the invisibility to preserve any energy she had left. The slash to her side was not helping matters. She looked down and in the darkness discerned an even darker stain spreading across the front of her shirt. Crimson oozed between her fingers and pattered on the floor. She leaned her head against the doorframe and tried to catch her breath. Sweat poured down her face and burned her eyes. It would not be long before Jandara found her. She feared she would have to confront her this time, in a clash she had little hope of winning. Light shimmered at the far end of the corridor. No time to rest. She shook off her lightheadedness and reached to touch her brooch. It was her only... Disembodied hands reached from behind through the darkness of the doorway. One clamped over her mouth before she could utter a scream, and the other grabbed her around her chest. Weakly, she struggled against the iron grip. It drew her slowly, inexorably inward, into the night dark room behind. Shh! Someone breathed into her ear. She began to think she had fallen into the darkness of the unconscious realm, where it was simply the unlit room, but her body fell limp and felt as if it floated upward and away to the night sky, perhaps to the heavens to meet the gods. Jandara smashed her hand into the wall until her knuckles bled. She had followed the greenie swiftly, but the blood trail simply ended in the doorway of an empty storeroom. She scoured every inch of the room, but it remained undisturbed. No strange shadows, no invisible presences, no telltale drips of blood. Jandara had to face it. She had failed. She was thankful she had not told her lord of her little errand. She had no wish to exact more punishment from him. She was tired, so tired. But what else was there? She had been devoted to Hamilton and his cause for years. She knew he could be cruel, but he had never punished her before the way he had the night of the Silver Moon. He was a different man from the smooth, dashing prince she had sworn her life to protect so long ago. She had once been an innocent, much like the greenie when she was younger, and a swordmaster in training. She was proud to serve Sacharidia and King Amagast. When she became a weapon assigned to protect Prince Hamilton, he swept her away with his charm. She lost her innocence then. She had made a choice. Reflecting on that choice and others, she knew she would still make them if she could do everything over again. That was where she and the greenie differed, she supposed. The greenie learned from her mistakes. She left the empty room and stumped down the corridor, the candlelight like a shield around her. When she reached the throne room, she found the merchant still sagging on his bench with the cargo master sitting stiff and resolute next to him, his arms crossed. Jandara thrust her bloodied sword tip in front of the merchant. He looked at it with bleary eyes. "This is the blood of your daughter," she hissed. "She is no ghost." She did not await his reaction and strode down the runner past the thinning ranks of defiant nobles. Among them was her old teacher, Devon Wainwright, a mighty warrior in her day, but now blind as a possum and reduced to being Zachary's advisor in her dotage. Jandara shook her head. She had once admired Devon, but now saw only a wrinkled and bent crone. Jandara did not wish herself such a long life. Crow and King Hamilton were speaking with the Merwellian soldier and did not note her presence, for which she was grateful.
"What did they say?"
Hamilton's cheeks were flushed, and his eyes flashed. Energy crackled about his clenched fists.
"Monarchy is tyranny, my lord."
The soldier licked his lips, and his eyes darted uncertainly from Crow to Hamilton.
"Who are they?"
"The Anti-Monarchy Society, my lord."
It was Castellan Crow who answered. He leaned on his staff of office, untroubled by the news.
"Your brother spoke of them from time to time, but they were a nuisance at best and nothing more. He did order the leader arrested, but didn't pursue the matter. He became a little more concerned when they found much support in North, but other matters demanded his attention."
"Do they malign my name?"
Hamilton asked.
"Yes, my lord," the soldier said. "They wish to abolish rule by a monarch completely. This they shout into the night, and their leader attracts an audience with their speeches.
The crackling on Hamilton's hands ceased, and he stroked his mustache.
You have archers up on the walls, don't you, Sergeant?
Yes, my lord.
Then let them practice their aim.
Very good, my lord.
The soldier bowed and left the throne room at a trot. Ignoring Jandara, Hamilton's eyes fastened on the small group of nobles still standing before him.
Well, well, if my eyes do not deceive me.
He walked among them and circled the tall blonde in black, looking her up and down.
Lady Astora, how good to see you again.
Jandara watched as Hamilton took the woman's pale hand in his and kissed it. The woman looked straight ahead, coolly ignoring him.
You are as beautiful as ever, my lady, Hamilton said.
His other hand trailed along her cheek and down her neck. Jandara's knuckles whitened in clenched fists. It had always been this way, he looking at others than she.
My lady,
Hamilton said in soft tones, as his face came unbearably close to the woman's.
My dear, dear heir of Coutray province, I've some interesting ideas for you.
Kerrigan was falling, falling from the sky, and she jerked convulsively to stop herself. She opened her eyes to the soft glow of a single candle. She had been asleep or unconscious and lay on stone. The hard, cold surface made her back ache. The candle did little to reveal the room she was in. It was stone like everywhere else in the castle, and though she could not discern dimensions, she sensed the walls to be close and the space vault-like. The candlelight glinted on glass, vials and jars on a shelf. The room smelled faintly of herbs and mustiness. The air was thick, as if it had been closed up for some time. The candlelight splayed across the ceiling. Glyphs and runes were carved there, so ancient they surpassed the old Sacheridian language. Crudely wrought images of Eric and Orion were also carved there, and others. One was of a creature, part man, part bird, the god Westrian, who escorted souls to the stars, and another was of his great steed, Salvastar, the harbinger of strife and battle. She lifted her head up to look around some more, but it throbbed, and she moaned.
Where am I?
The preparation room, someone said.
Kerrigan's heart skipped a beat. Who's there? The disembodied hands returned, this time accompanied by a disembodied face with familiar stony features, aglow in the candlelight.
Fastian!
The weapon who had so often guarded her door at Ryder Barracks drew closer, and she could make out the outline of his broad frame. His black uniform had created the illusion of disembodiment.
You are awake, then?
He said.
Yes. What do you mean this is a preparation room?
It is for the dead, he said. It is here the royal death surgeons prepare the bodies of kings, queens, and the special ones, chosen to reside in the Hall of Kings and Queens, or along Heroes Avenue. It is here they open the body from the chin.
He put his finger to his chin and drew a line with it down to his stomach.
To the gut, so that the soul may escape the body and float to the heavens. It is an ancient rite.
Kerrigan sat up, heart pounding. Suddenly she feared Fastian. Here she was, laid out on the funerary slab of royalty, where they were embalmed and prepared for the grave. What did Fastian intend?
Easy, Fastian said, or you're going to start bleeding again.
Then he must have recognized her fear, for he crossed his arms and said,
If I planned to prepare you for death, I wouldn't have bound up that sword wound, and your soul would have been in the heavens long ago.
Kerrigan tentatively touched her side, where Jandara's blade had cut her. It was indeed bound with linens.
Lots of bandages here, Fastian said.
For wrapping the dead. He nodded. I'm sorry I mistrusted you, but it has been a very long day, and this is strange.
It is strange for me, too. This room has memories for me.
Fashtin's eyes roamed the room as if in search of images of the past.
Before I became a weapon for King Zachary, I was a tomb guard. I guarded King Amagast and his death, and watched over the surgeons, lest they did something to damage him or impair his soul. As I said, the rites are ancient.
I would like to get off this slab, Kerrigan said. It was too much. Fashtin put his hand on her shoulder and pressed her back.
I realize how uncomfortable this must be, but you have to rest while you can. You seem weak, and on more than account of blood loss. We can talk while you recover, but first, I need to know if you have news of the king.
He lives. Joy crossed Fashtin's normally impassive face, and any doubt of his intentions faded completely.
Then there is hope, he said.
Kerrigan told him of the day's events and about her purpose at the castle. I must return to them and tell them what I've seen. My own father is trapped in the throne room with Hamilton and Jandara.
The traitor!
Fashtin broke in with vehemence.
I would have taken her on the corridor, but I had my arms full with you.
Sorry, Kerrigan said.
Do not apologize. I'm glad I could help after what you have told me. Killing Jandara would have brought me some satisfaction, but it would have raised an alarm and ruined all hope. You see, I've been trying to reach the tombs. I expect to find others there, more weapons. I'm hoping they have been forgotten by Hamilton, or they have been able to resist attacks by his forces.
How many do you think there are? Kerrigan asked.
Perhaps as many as 20, but I would guess fewer. As you know, one weapon is worth 4 or more ordinary soldiers.
Yes, Kerrigan said. I do know. Fashtin looked pleased.
We may not possess greeny magics, but we have our own skills. We have secrets.
Kerrigan lay in silence. The cold of the slab was getting to her, as was the closeness of the room. There was no telling how much time had been lost, but half the candle had dripped away as they spoke. Fashtin, she said, I've got to get back to the king and the others to let them know what I learned.
Can you stand?
She dropped her legs over the slab. Her head throbbed mightily. She nearly fell back on the slab.
A little at a time, Fashtin said.
He produced some dried meat and water left over from his own supper. It had been some time since midday when Kerrigan had sat with Alton beneath the sun at their picnic. Would she ever see the sun again? The food improved her spirits considerably, and she felt much stronger. Now she could stand, though she had to hold on to the slab at first to keep steady.
I will guard you out, Fashtin said. You must tell the king when you see him to remember the hero's portal. He must have walked those paths when a boy. His grandmother would have seen to it. I will try to reach the tombs and assemble all the weapons I can. There, on Heroes Avenue, we shall meet you and the king.
The tombs?
Yes.
Kerrigan had a vague suspicion she would never truly extricate herself from dealings with the dead. Ghosts, killings, and now tombs. Fashtin led Kerrigan through black corridors and a series of rooms, then down more corridors. He relied only on a single candle to light the way. Why is it so dark here? Kerrigan asked. Isn't this part of the castle used?
No longer, the weapon said. This section could house hundreds, as it once did. Troops, mostly, were garrisoned here in more restless days.
A very long time ago, then?
Yes. We weapons know it all. All the corridors and rooms. We must. Quite a lot of history back here. There are even some Green Rider relics. I keep meaning to tell Captain Mapstone, but I get tied up in my duties and forget.
The route Fashtin took seemed like that of an endless cave or maze. When one candle melted down, he lit another. Their footsteps were hollow on the stone-flagged floor. Time seemed not to exist in this netherworld. They passed numerous doors. Moth-eaten tapestries rustled on the walls as they walked by, and their feet stirred up dust. They caught the glow of a rat's eye in the candlelight as it scurried across the corridor.
The servants really ought to clean down here, Fashtin muttered.
Beside the tapestries, Rusted arms and shields hung on the walls. The shields bore the devices of regiments, the evergreen, the sea dog, the wild rose, the catamount, the black bear, and the eagle. One shield of green featured the gold-winged horse. So the Green Riders were once garrisoned with the rest of the militia, Kerrigan said.
At wartime, yes. Green Riders served not only as couriers, but in other capacities, such as light cavalry. There are other things that are not disclosed in the history books, so I can only guess.
Kerrigan could, too. Capacities like the one Beryl Spencer served in. You sound like a historian, she said. Fashton glanced at her with a smile.
I am versed in more than weaponry skills.
Kerrigan smiled back, abashed. Finally, Fashton stopped at a heavy door bound in iron.
This opens into the main courtyard, he said, so you must take care. We're some couple hundred yards from the main entrance and the gates. There are apt to be soldiers all about, but not directly guarding this door. It is somewhat obscure.
He turned and pulled on a huge iron ring, and if Kerrigan was expecting the hinges to creak and shriek with age, she was to be disappointed, for someone had made a point of oiling them. Fresh night air rolled into the corridor, and Kerrigan breathed deeply, finally feeling she was going to be freed of the tomb-like atmosphere of the castle.
I would use your, ability, Fashton said, to get across the courtyard. Have your horse?
He's down in the city, she said.
Good. Remember, the hero's portal. The king should remember it. May Eric and Orion guide you.
And you, Kerrigan said. With some regret, she touched her brooch and stepped out into the night. The door closed shut behind her, and she was on her own. Shrubbery concealed the doorway, and she peered around it. Soldiers milled around, walking here and there, to whatever business called them to duty at this late hour. There was not enough light to reveal her, and she darted across the courtyard at a trot to the inner wall. She hugged it until she neared the guardhouse and gate. Someone barked orders to those standing on the wall, but she was not going to wait around to find out what those orders were about. She watched the sentries cross paths, gauged where the shadows were deepest beneath the portcullis, and she ran. As her feet thudded on the drawbridge, she heard the command.
Ready arrows!
Oh no, she groaned. Across the moat, the Anti-Monarchy Society shouted slogans and shook fists. A crowd had assembled to watch.
Find your sights! Wait for my mark, the soldier commanded.
Kerrigan pounded across the bridge and headed straight for the Anti-Monarchy Society. She could imagine the archers, poised between the crenellations atop the wall, holding their bowstrings taut. It would be slaughter. The Anti-Monarchy Society was grouped at an easy arrow's flight from the wall, and the street lamps made them visible targets. Kerrigan dropped her invisibility as she charged them, and no few mouths fell open. Run! She shouted. They're going to—
Loose arrows!
The command rang through the night. Arrows rained from the sky, impaling members of the Anti-Monarchy Society and the crowd, skidding along the paving stones of the street or sticking in the ground. Screams and cries surrounded Kerrigan. The terrified living stampeded the wounded and dead. Kerrigan was jostled from every side by the panicked onrush of people. And again, the command rang out, Loose arrows! People dropped on either side of Kerrigan. An arrow skimmed her shoulder. When she came to the first building beyond the castle wall, she veered around it to safety. A dozen or so other people had done likewise, Lorelei Duran among them. She was on the ground, an arrow jammed in her thigh. She gasped in pain. Two of her followers hovered solicitously over her.
King Zachary would never have done this, Lorelei said.
Kerrigan strode over to her. Her own side was stinging from her desperate run. When her shadow fell across Lorelei, the charismatic leader of the Anti-Monarchy Society looked up at her.
Perhaps you should support King Zachary rather than malign him,
Kerrigan said. What you've got now is a real tyrant claiming the throne. Lorelai squinted through her pain.
I remember you, sister. North, you were there. You were a Green Rider?
Kerrigan shook her head. I am not your sister, nor am I a Green Rider.
All monarchy is tyranny.
Kerrigan glanced over her shoulder at the bodies bristled with arrows lying in the street. Some people were trying to drag themselves along. Others knelt on the ground, wailing.
Is this worth it?
Kerrigan asked her, gesturing at the wounded and dead.
Yes,
Lorelai whispered fiercely.
Yes, they died for me. They died for the cause. Their sacrifice will only strengthen it.
The woman was despicable. Believe what you will, then. Kerrigan whirled around and ran, disappearing into the shadows as she went. Heroes Avenue. Kerrigan rode Condor through the city, vanishing only if she saw Merwellians or mercenaries, but otherwise heedless of others who might see her. Some in the city spoke of seeing the restless spirit of the First Rider rush by on her fiery steed. The First Rider, they said, was angered by the overthrow of King Zachary. Some heard only pounding hooves and a passing breeze. Others saw the rider's ghostly figure or a streak of green. Kerrigan blew through the final gates of the city, riding across the countryside like a demon until she reached the thicket of woods where she had left the others. As she pulled up on the reins, a single figure stood there, cloaked and hooded in gray.
No! Kerrigan cried. The Shadow Man!
If he was here, that meant the others must be in danger. She drew the king's sword and ran Condor straight at the figure. The Shadow Man jumped to the side just in time. Kerrigan reined Condor around for another pass, but the figure cried out,
Kerrigan, stop! It's me!
Captain Mapstone pulled back the hood, revealing her bandaged head. Kerrigan dismounted, relieved but weary, and led Condor toward her.
I'm sorry, Captain Mapstone said. I wasn't expecting you just then.
Connolly found this cloak in the city while you were gone, and we thought it might prove useful for Beryl's plan. The others emerged from the woods.
At least we know it works, Beryl said.
The king looked Kerrigan up and down.
You've been hurt, he said.
He took her elbow apprehensively. Kerrigan then realized she was on her knees. A line of blood had seeped through Fashion's bandage. Helping hands lifted her to her feet and led her into the woods.
It looks worse than it is, she said. It's the brooch. I'm exhausted.
The mender pushed between Captain Mapstone and the king.
I'll be the judge of that, she said.
They sat Kerrigan down on the blanket, allowing her to lean against the trunk of a tree. The mender checked her wound with gentle hands.
I have a terrible headache from the brooch, Kerrigan said.
I've roots for you that should help the pain.
The mender rebandaged the wound and said,
It is not deep, but if you keep riding around the countryside, it won't knit together.
Couldn't help it, Kerrigan said.
The mender rolled her eyes.
You riders are all alike. You make the worst patients. Next to other menders, of course.
Then she gave Captain Mapstone a stern look.
I know you have questions to ask, but she is in need of rest. Don't push her.
Kerrigan eased herself against the tree trunk, glad, at least, to be visible among friends again.
Do you feel able to talk? The king asked.
His eyes were wide with concern as he gazed down at her.
I must look beyond redemption, she thought, with some amusement.
The exertion of battle and having walked through those old, dusty castle corridors made a hot bath seem a heavenly dream.
I have a lot to report, she said.
The king and captain glanced at one another, then beckoned Horse Marshal Martell, Beryl Spencer, and Conley over. They sat in a semicircle about Kerrigan as she told them, as briefly as possible, of her adventures. When she described her encounter with Mel, Captain Mapstone's face fell, and she looked away. She seemed little relieved, when Kerrigan told her Mel was safe when she last saw her.
The castle. Ryder Barracks is no place for a child to grow up, Captain Mapstone said.
Beryl placed her hand on the captain's shoulder.
She loves you, and that's what matters.
Kerrigan told of Prince Hamilton and how he used magic to torture, kill, and coerce the nobles. Magic surrounded his hands, and it was like what the Elysian used.
On me, she did not add.
My father was in the throne room with the others. He seemed fine, but I didn't dare talk to him.
She recounted her narrow escape from Jandara and how she received the wound. She told of Fashion's help.
The hero's portal, Zachary murmured. I remember. Yes, it's perfect. Good old Fashion. His years as a tomb guard have served him, and served us well.
The others did not understand what he was talking about, and he didn't enlighten them other to say,
It is another way in.
When she told of the attack on the Anti-Monarchy Society, Zachary said,
My brother has turned into a despot of the worst sort. I fear he will not confine his brutality to those within and around the castle. The city may be in peace right now, but how long before he extends his reach among ordinary citizens and into the provinces?
While the king, the captain, and the others talked among themselves, Kerrigan dozed off. Their distant voices became the babble of ghosts hanging on the fringes of the living world. Her dreams followed dark roots, dim passages of stone and earth. The ghost babbles shivered up and down the walls in whispery echoes. She entered a vault-like room where pale blue light hovered over a stone slab. Glyphs and carvings of funerary rites on tablets covered the walls. Similar figures ornamented the base of the slab. Kerrigan walked over to the slab, sat on it, swung her legs up onto it, and lay down. Disembodied hands pulled a gauzy shroud over her.
No!
Kerrigan sat up, wincing at the soreness of her side.
You're all right, said a soothing voice.
Kerrigan blinked. She felt the fresh air of night blowing through her hair and made out the outlines of branches against the starry night. The king was sitting beside her, pulling a blanket over her.
I thought you might get cold, he said.
Kerrigan pushed her hair out of her eyes.
Thanks, I had a dream.
He nodded.
You have been through a great many things today. I shouldn't be surprised if you do have dreams.
Where are the others?
Major Spencer, Captain Mapstone, Conley, and Merwell are preparing to enter the city.
What?
The king absently ran his hands through his hair. His silver fillet was missing. Without it, he seemed an ordinary man with the shock of amber hair falling into his eyes. But he was a haggard man, tired and careworn. He seemed to have aged years over the course of a day.
They are taking my head and crown to my brother.
He smiled impishly.
What?
It is part of Beryl's plan to infiltrate the throne room. My brother knows little of her true affiliations, as of yet. Captain Mapstone will be cloaked as the Elysian, and Conley volunteered to take the part of the Moellian Guard. You see, with our outnumbered forces, our only hope is to win the castle from within.
But the Lord Governor, Kerrigan said, how will he cooperate?
Beryl said she would see to it.
Is that it? I mean, the whole plan?
Oh, no.
Zachary seemed to enjoy telling her the plan. Despite his haggard appearance, there was a light in his brown eyes.
Horse Marshal Martel, a good number of his soldiers and I, will enter the hero's portal and infiltrate the castle that way. Alas, unlike Conley and Captain Mapstone, we have no disguise. Upon reaching the throne room, I shall reclaim the crown, and Merwell will order his troops to regroup and return home.
What about me? Kerrigan asked.
Hmm?
What part do I play?
You have already done more than your share, he said. You will rest here with the day's other wounded, and the remainder of Marshal Martel's troops. Should we fail, well, I can depend on you to move these people out of harm's way.
No,
Kerrigan said. The king raised a brow.
No?
Kerrigan shoved the blanket off and raised herself to her feet. I'm going with you. King or not, you can't stop me. My father is being held in the throne room.
You are wounded and exhausted, Zachary said. I don't want you to slow us down.
You have a broken arm, Kerrigan retorted. Who will be slowing who? The king's eyebrows shot up, and his mouth was quirked in a half-smile he couldn't quite hide. It was as if he wanted to laugh, but he knew better than to do so.
I see, he said.
Horse Marshal Martell appeared at the king's side, his face impassive.
I told you, my lord. We should have left her while she was asleep.
I should have listened more closely, he said.
I suppose she would have followed us,
the marshal said.
Captain Mapstone tells me the girl operates on pure spunk, and from what I've seen, I cannot argue.
Kerrigan glowered at both men. The appreciation I get for... The king bent close to her, and in a sober tone he said,
I am indebted to you, brave lady, more times over than I can count. I do not wish to belittle your accomplishments. If you wish to join us, I will not deny you. But also know, I could be leading you to your death.
Without his fillet, she had almost forgotten he was king. Just as seriously as he, she said, I must go. The moon was at its apex and beginning to slide into the western sky as King Zachary, Kerrigan, Horse Marshal Martell, the weapon Rory, and about 25 cavalry soldiers rode in a circumference around the outskirts of Sacker City, far enough to be out of eyeshot and hearing of guards on the walls. They rode in silence, and they rode without light, save that cast by the moon. High on its hill, the castle sat at the center of it all, its stony facade rotating, changing angles as they rode. Tiny lights twinkled about it, making it appear as some celestial palace of the night, rather than a behemoth of granite constructed by mere humans and anchored firmly to the earth. On the northeast side, they slowed their horses to a walk. The king and his weapon Rory rode in front, quietly consulting with one another. A single white obelisk, cracked and splotched by yellow lichens, marked the spot where an age-old road began. Horse hooves clicked and clattered on blocks of granite paving stones. Grasses and saplings grew up through the cracks between the stones. An ancient grove of hemlock bowed over the path, plunging it into an even deeper darkness than the bare night. They came upon a stone slab set beside the path, and all at once, Kerrigan could feel the cold stone on her back. Like the slab in the preparation room, only this one was covered with thick mosses, lichens, and a layer of dead leaves. A fern grew from the base. This was a coffin rest, the king explained. A rest for those who bore the one to be interred in Heroes Avenue. The group rode on, like silent mourners, until they came to a rock ledge that loomed above them and was overhung with dripping mosses. Another obelisk stood like an accusing finger next to a round portal of iron embedded in the ledge. King Zachary faced those who followed him with a grim smile.
You follow the ancient path. Only the dead, royalty, and those who care for the dead are permitted. This entrance has been forgotten by most, and has lain mostly unused for a century at least. The dead, alas, keep their own company.
He sat without speaking for some moments, as water trickled down the ledge to a puddle beside him.
When I was a boy, my grandmother, Queen Eisen, brought me here so I could learn the stories of Sacheridia's bravest heroes. I was terrified then, and I am none too comfortable now. To say the least, it is disturbing to see the inside of your tomb while you still live and breathe.
Kerrigan shifted uneasily on Condor's back. The night seemed to crackle with premonition. The accusatory obelisk telling them to turn back, the iron portal with the glyph of Westerian on it.
Beyond this portal, Zachary said, lies the domain of the dead, from which only members of the royal family and weapons may reemerge. All others who trespass must spend the remainder of their lives along its somber avenues, tending the dead, never to see the light of the living day again.
The cavalry soldiers exchanged worried glances and whispered among themselves.
However,
the king said.
I am in a position to change the rules for one night, under these circumstances in which we ride. It would be different, perhaps, if we were entering the halls of kings and queens where the royalty sleeps. Heroes Avenue is slightly more permissible, more forgiving to the intrusion of the living.
He looked at each person as if he could look right into their souls. Kerrigan was not warmed by his gaze.
Here, we shall leave the horses.
As one, the soldiers dismounted. They gathered together bundles of torches they had brought with them, and King Zachary smiled.
Leave them, he said. We enter a tomb, not a cave.
The soldiers murmured uncertainly and shrugged. Rory ran his hands over the portal and pushed on the glyph of Westrian. It swung open easily, with just a minimal scraping of iron on granite, thanks, no doubt, to the vigilance of the weapons who guarded the tombs. A breath of cool air issued out, thick with the scent of earth and rock. One by one they filed into the round opening wide enough for a coffin and pallbearers. The corridor they entered was tube-like. Although it was not lit, light shone at the far end, and it was enough for them to see by. Miraculously, the shaft was dry and the speckled grain of the granite walls smooth and uncracked. Although the underground world was not damp, a heavy cold penetrated through Kerrigan's coat and into her very bones.
The craftsmanship,
the horse marshal murmured.
It has never been matched,
King Zachary said.
The tombs may have been delved before even the time of the Camarnians.
The tube opened into a larger, low-ceilinged chamber lit by flickering lamps. To Kerrigan, it felt as if the earth above pressed down on them. The taller among them had to bow their heads in order not to bump them on the ceilings. Another coffin rest stood in the middle of the room, its base decorated with the now familiar glyphs and ancient Sacheridian script. Several corridors branched off from this chamber, but only one was lit. Five black-clad weapons dressed in padded tunics and trousers and fur-lined cloaks awaited them there and fell on their knees before the king.
Rise, he told them. What news have you?
A woman stepped forward and inclined her head.
I am Sergeant Brienne Quinn, my lord, she said. Weapon Fashion sent us to await you here. We are honored by your presence.
Zachary nodded. Where is Fashion?
He keeps watch above at the main portal, guarding it lest Prince Hamilton thinks to assault this place.
And how many are with him?
Another 10, my lord.
Excellent. No one will get past them.
Brienne beamed with pride.
It is our sacred duty to protect those who rest here.
Let us go, then. Lead on, Sergeant.
Yes, my lord.
Brienne turned smartly on her heel and walked to the front. One weapon stayed with her. The other three dropped to the rear, much to the relief of the cavalry soldiers by the expressions on their faces. The weapons seemed content to leave Rory as the king's personal guard. Though they would fight to the death for the king, their place was as tomb guards. Others cared for the living. They followed another shaft, but this one was square with lamps fitted in alcoves along the way. The walls were a riot of colors, painted with battle scenes and heroic images. Armor-clad knights charged the field on battle horses, pennons rippling on lowered lances. Others, dressed in full mail, battled dark enemies with swords. Some stood at rest, their fingers shaped in the sign of the crescent moon.
These walls could tell stories,
Marshal Martell said. He shifted his helm beneath his arm.
I wouldn't be surprised if they held more knowledge than all the repositories of Selium.
The mention of the school Kerrigan had run away from was jarring. It had been a lifetime ago, her time at Selium. Perhaps it had been a different life altogether. She certainly felt like a different person from that schoolgirl who had run away for some petty reason she could hardly remember. They emerged into another chamber, this one vast and wide, still maintaining the low ceiling which was supported by many square granite pillars. There were rows of granite slabs. None were occupied.
It seems no one has been interred for quite a while,
Horse Marshal Martell said.
King Zachary overheard and replied, We've been at peace for so long. We've had few heroes.
They passed into another such room, and another. Each was brightly lit, hardly the dark, shadowy tomb Kerrigan had envisioned. The stone floor was polished. No cobwebs hung in doorways. Dust did not swirl about their feet. Though cold, the air was good and vented without the stench of decay or bones. The unused section of the castle Fashion had led her through was far gloomier, more funereal than this place. Even so, Kerrigan felt tense. She felt as if someone watched their procession with unfriendly eyes. Sometimes she caught the movement of a shadow out of the corner of her own eye, but when she looked, it was gone. It was as if someone were flitting from behind one funeral slab to another. No one else seemed to notice, so she kept her peace for the time being. Tombs and lamplight and exhaustion could produce strange visions. The next room was not empty. Shrouded forms lay like sleepers beneath gauzy linen sheets. Others, in full gleaming armor, lay with weapons drawn at their feet. Some were encased in sarcophagi, with carved effigies on the lids. In the next room, and the rooms after that, every slab was filled. There were rows upon rows of shrouded dead. Kerrigan kept her eyes to Horse Marshal Martell's back, or to the floor. Somehow, dealing with the spirits of the dead was easier than walking among their long-abandoned remains. She felt very mortal, very small. Their path gradually shifted upward, and it seemed they had walked miles.
"Sacharidia certainly has its share of heroes,"
the marshal remarked. Unlike Kerrigan, he did not have trouble looking around at his surroundings.
"Wars," King Zachary said. "Some date from the Long War and before."
He smiled back at them.
"Few know the magnitude of what Sacker City rests on." "A good thing," Marshal Martell said.
Kerrigan sneaked a peek and saw the jutting angles of bones beneath one shroud. Another, lumpy form was bound in linens. The king paused, then whispered something to Brienne.
"Yes," she said,
and pointed to a far corner. King Zachary turned to Kerrigan and beckoned her to follow. He walked off among the slabs in the direction Brienne had pointed. Kerrigan hesitated with a sense of loathing to walk among those desiccated, brittle husks. With her jaw clenched, she plunged after him, avoiding direct contact with the slabs, and keeping her eyes to the floor. In the far corner, the king stopped by a slab and peered down at its occupant. Upon it rested a linen-wrapped form, covered by a shroud. A length of green and blue plaid fabric was draped over it from hips to toes. The head was tightly wrapped with sunken depressions where the eyes had been. Mounted on the wall behind the remains were a two-handed greatsword, a battle axe, and a saber. Above the corpse, painted on the ceiling, was the portrait of a woman, astride a big bay stallion. She wore the plaid about her shoulders and carried the saber, and a shield bearing the gold-winged horse on a field of green. Warmth blossomed on Kerrigan's chest where her brooch was pinned. She touched it. It was hot and seemed to sing, not audibly, but she could feel it sing through her.
"The first rider," King Zachary said. "She was a great hero of the Long War. I know such time has passed that green riders have lost some of their glory, and few recognize their worth. But they come of great lineage."
Kerrigan's head spun. The walls seemed to close in even tighter. Hoofbeats drummed in her ears. She wanted to run away.
"I will likely have need of my sword before the night is over," the king was saying.
He flexed his good arm.
"I'm fortunate that ground mite broke my shield arm and not my sword arm."
"I, Kerrigan said, suddenly wondering why he wanted his sword now. She lifted the baldric over her head and handed it to him.
"I shouldn't think the first rider would begrudge you borrowing one of her swords," the king said.
Kerrigan took a sharp intake of breath.
"I can't."
"Why not? She doesn't need it, and you do."
I...
She backed away until she bumped into another of the horrible slabs behind her. She jumped as if the corpse had pinched her.
"I don't want you to go up above unarmed," the king said.
Pick a sword.
Kerrigan hooked a strand of hair behind her ear. But the king's face was set. All right, she said. She edged around the slab and gazed at the weapons. The greatsword was almost taller than she. The first rider must have been a tall and powerful woman. She reached for the saber. The thrum of hoofbeats intensified as she did so, as if urging her to take it. The brooch sang in resonance as Kerrigan's fingers closed around the hilt. The sword came off the wall easily and weighed well in her hand. The hoofbeats dissipated, and the vibrations of the brooch eased. She sighed in relief. A bundle of gray and white robes, like a corpse springing to life, arose from behind one of the slabs and launched on her. They toppled to the hard granite floor and rolled. The creature tussled with her, grabbing for the sword. Kerrigan was so shocked she let it go. The mass of robes scurried away and huddled at the king's feet, cradling the sword. Rory and Brienne were there in moments, towering over the quivering heap.
"Are you all right?" the king asked Kerrigan.
He stretched out a hand to help her rise to her feet. The wind had been knocked out of her, and her side ached, but she suffered mostly from shock. She nodded, looking curiously at the creature that had attacked her. Brienne's hands were on her hips, and her expression was severe.
"Agamon," she said.
The ragged bundle quavered at her voice, and she rolled her eyes in annoyance.
"Sheath your sword," she told Rory.
He obeyed without question. She addressed the bundle again.
"Agamon, do not hinder the king."
The bundle shifted and whimpered.
"Nervous as a winter hare," Rory commented.
"He is a caretaker," Brienne said. "They are overwhelmed by the living."
"Yes, yes,"
the creature whined.
"Arise, Agamon,"
the king said in a commanding voice. The quivering mass stood up and turned into an old man with long gray hair and a curiously pale, unwrinkled face. His robes, though not old or worn, were of muted and dusty tones, like that of the linen-wrapped dead. He held the sword possessively to his chest and adjusted a pair of specs on the tip of his nose.
"You need not fear us," King Zachary said.
"Honored," the man squeaked. "Honored to have you, great king, and your black shield. But these others, these blues, this green, these do not belong in the presence of the great ones. These colors do not belong unless they be heroes, unless they are dead."
"I tolerate their presence," King Zachary said. "And among them are heroes worthy of traveling these avenues."
"But they live," the man said desperately. "They breathe. They contaminate the dead."
Zachary placed his hand on the little man's shoulder.
"I've the right to bring them here. I've broken no taboo."
"They must stay and be caretakers. They must never see the living sun again."
"No," Zachary said. "They come with me. They all protect me. They all protect the tombs."
"As you say, my lord. As you say."
Agamon adjusted his specs again, his features full of despair.
"But this one,"
and he pointed at Kerrigan,
"has touched the great embryo sword. She must stay."
"No," the king said. "You must give her the sword back, and she must leave with me. I promise the sword will be returned. I don't think the first rider will mind."
I don't know.
Agamon shook his head, his expression of despair deepening.
"Give it to her," Brienne snapped.
Agamon jumped, then thrust the sword out to Kerrigan. Kerrigan took it and stepped back. He gave her a wizened look, his eyes shifting from her head to her toes, as if to deem whether or not she was worthy.
"She is touched by the dead already, anyway. I guess I will not mind."
His pronouncement was like a cold hand on the back of Kerrigan's neck. Agamon turned back to the king.
"The Birdman will not be happy about this."
"Westrian understands," King Zachary said. He glanced at Brienne. "We haven't the time to debate it."
"Understood, my lord."
She took Agamon's arm and pulled him aside.
"Agamon, you must continue your duties. Do you understand?"
Yes, yes.
He waved her off and started ambling down the corridor.
I polish the Great Heath's armor. Yes, yes. Heath the iron-handed, I polish his armor.
Brienne sighed.
I'm sorry, my lord, but he is the chief caretaker, and he feels responsible for the intrusion of the undead.
I know, King Zachary said. I suppose the others are too timid to come forward.
She smiled.
They are. Some won't even talk to us.
How many are down here? Kerrigan asked, wondering with revulsion how anyone could live in this mass tomb.
Perhaps 50, perhaps 100. It is difficult to say, for they are secretive. Some have family that have lived here for generations. From time to time we try to move families up above, but often enough they can't adjust. The move goes against anything they have learned about not seeing the living light.
Kerrigan frowned with distaste.
Where do they live? Not too far removed from the dead, in their own chambers. It is their way. It has always been so.
Shall we move on? King Zachary suggested. I am guessing Beryl and Captain Mapstone are somewhere within the city walls by now. It would not be well for them if we were late.
A Weapon's Wrath. Remember, old man, Beryl said. I will have a dagger to your back the whole time. If you speak one wrong word, I will use it. Merwell sat hunched in his saddle, bone-weary and cold under the blanket of night. The city lamps held no warmth, only an icy glow. If only he had his bear pelt to throw over his shoulders. His Beryl Spencer of old would have fetched it for him without hesitation, but now she wasn't his. She never was. She rode knee to knee with him as they approached the second city gate. Mapstone rode behind, her gray hood drawn over her face, and next to her, the rider Conley, dressed in Drang's scarlet uniform. To complete the illusion, Mapstone rode Conley's gray mare. If Merwell were a less pragmatic man, he might have been amused by the irony of his situation. He and Beryl had virtually switched roles, he, now the captive, she, the captor. He had been fooled by her pretty face, hard work, and seemingly unfeigned loyalty. She had been the spy in House Merwell all along, while he thought her to be his most trustworthy officer, above Captain Imerys and all others. Merwell admitted it to himself. He had been duped. Yet the ultimate move of the game of intrigue had not been played out. He still possessed the Grey One's magic words of power to use at the most appropriate moment. They halted before the city gate, and the guards, in his own color of scarlet, held a lantern up to see who rode in.
"Lord Merwell," the guard said in surprise, "and Major Spencer."
He and the others bowed.
"We are glad to see you. King Hamilton, was concerned about you, seeing how late it is. He sent word for us to keep watch."
"Then send a messenger up to the castle and tell him we come," Beryl said. "Tell the king we bring him a great prize."
"Yes, Major."
The lantern light showed on Beryl's ruthless smile. A great prize indeed, Merwell thought. He glanced back at the basket Mapstone carried. How long before their ruse would be discovered? At Beryl's signal, Merwell prodded his horse forward and he rode beside her through the gate. The guards bowed respectfully, and he knew their eyes were on the gray-cloaked figure riding behind, bearing the basket. Ahead of them, a messenger rode off at a canter, and the clatter of hooves receded into the night. Beryl might be pleased by her little charade, but Merwell could reveal it at any moment, knowing that whatever happened to him, his soldiers would see to her death. She had promised to kill him should he reveal their deception, and he knew she spoke the truth. But he must exercise patience and play along for now. He was not ready to sacrifice himself. He still had one move to make, and her plan, after all, was flawed.
"Don't you think someone will not see through your plan?"
he asked her.
"Hamilton has met the Grey One," he said. "That woman is not the Grey One."
His pronouncement was met with soft laughter from behind. "No," Captain Mapstone said in a low voice. "I am the Green One." We need but little time in the throne room to accomplish what we must. It won't matter who we really are. A pity Beryl had not killed the woman during the battle. It was unfortunate time.